More than 60 episodes of this podcast, So-Called Normal, have focused on the experiences and insights of those living with, coping with, and managing their own mental health. And some have identified their challenges as mental illness, but many more have framed their mental health in the context of just the messiness of life. In this special four-part limited podcast series, you'll hear the remarkable story of Mark Hennick. We hear his own account of a suicide attempt at the age of 15. We hear the matter-of-fact story of his rescue. And we hear the personal story of an ordinary man who did the extraordinary. Here's your host, Mark Hennick.
My life, as I know it now, really didn't begin until I tried to end it. It was a cold, wet Cape Breton Sunday night, March 2003. This is the end, I thought. I was determined that it would be my end. I was in a state of focused, practiced determination. I had climbed over the railing of a bridge. I'd perched myself on an inch and a half of concrete on the wrong side in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I was fully prepared to launch myself out over the edge and to greet the ground below. I still, to this day, don't know how long I stood there. Time does funny things when you're distorted in your mind like this, but when I did let go, since there was practically nothing under my feet, I began to fall. I remember the ground coming toward me as I fell. And then I remember seeing the arm of a stranger. He was wearing a light brown jacket. As I looked down and saw the ground coming toward my face, I saw his arm wrap around my chest. And he pulled me backward against the railing so hard that it knocked the wind out of me and my feet flew up off of the edge. I dangled there for what seemed like forever. And then he pulled me back. I didn't know it then, but Mike Ritchie was my savior that night. Sure, he pulled me off of the edge of a bridge. He saved my life in that moment. But he actually ended up giving me my entire life from that moment. As you heard in episodes 1 and 2 of our limited series so far, I had reached the end of the line. I felt like I was unhelpable. I was broken. And that it would be better for everybody if I was gone. I had climbed up over the railing of a bridge, ready to die. But Mike Ritchie, a stranger at the time, stopped, and he saved me. He pulled me off that bridge. He'd only been working as a youth care worker for a short time. He had no training in suicide intervention. He saw me. He stopped his car. And eventually, he stopped me, too. But where did Mike Ritchie go after he pulled me to safety that night?
I left the bridge that night and went to work. I finished my shift, I went home in the morning, and at the time, myself and two friends were renting a house in Sydney. So I told my friends when they got up the next day, like, what had happened the night before.
How did your friends react to that?
Just as, you know, kind of as you'd expect, like, oh, that's crazy. You know, yeah, like, yeah. But so it was just kind of this, you know, the people that were close to me knew what had happened, and I was just like, I don't know. People ask, like, what had happened? What happened to the kid? What happened to the boy? Right. I don't know.
So did your parents know? Your
yeah.
Mother
oh, yeah. They yeah. they knew. So yeah, just kind of casually, people that have been close to me over the years, it's come up the odd time, you know, like, and so people were aware of the story and stuff. It's a small world because the night that you were taken to the hospital after the incident on the bridge. One of the nurses there that tended to you is now, well, the wife of one of my best friends who I was living with at the time.
Yeah. And so the roommate who reached out to me then,
yes,
it's his wife.
Oh my God. So
I remember you telling me that before, and that blows my mind. Although it's also a small town too, right?
Yeah, and I mean, in terms of just with the nature of her work for confidentiality, I wasn't even aware. I didn't know that. So this was long after the fact that so before you had gone on Canada AM or reached out trying to find me in any way, I want to say like a month or so beforehand. Completely out of the blue, I'm at work, and my friend contacts me, and he says, check this out. There's a TED Talk, and it sounds like the story of both this guy's from Cape Breton, and the story he's telling sounds like it's from that night on the bridge.
Yeah. And you still had no idea if I was
I had no
still
idea
alive.
if that was I'm like, no, can't be right. Like it's coincidence or something. But
and Ted, I mean, Ted still is a big thing, but especially a couple of years ago, everybody knows what TED Talks
are.
Yeah, right?
For sure. So I mean, when I was at work, he had sent me the link to it and just hit play on the video, and I just started watching it and listening to you recount what I lived through on the other end of it. I'm like, this is the kid, and he's grown up, and seeing what you're doing with your life, I got incredibly emotional. It was tough for me to clear my head enough to go back to work at that point, because I wanted to watch the whole thing, but I didn't. I couldn't just disappear for that
Take
long.
20 minutes or whatever, 15 minutes.
So it was an emotional moment.
Did you know that it was me right away?
I kind of had, like, you looked like what I remember. You still looked familiar to me, even in the TED Talk, but I wasn't 100% until you started telling the story. Sure. So then when I went home and I watched it, it occupied my thoughts completely for a couple of days, just thinking, like, just how crazy the whole thing is. Mm. 'Cause, as I said, you could have been not even here anymore. So
you eventually did go watch the whole thing.
I did. I need to reach out to him, but I didn't know if it was something. I'm like, that was such a traumatic part of this person's life. Yeah. And it isn't my place to bust in and kind of like tear up any old memories that maybe you didn't want to revisit or you'd like, but for myself, I felt like I had a lot of things I wanted to say to you. So sure. I just figured the best thing for me to do would be to sit down and just write an email to like a letter to this person that I may never hit send, but I just want to get all these things out that I'm thinking and I'm feeling.
Right. And had you any way, did you know where I was or any way to contact me at that point?
I didn't really look it up too much. I figured it wouldn't be hard to track you down But I had to decide if that was my place or not. So that was kind of where I was at for a while. I had written this letter that I wanted to send, but was just back and forth for a while. And then this timing was just so strange because I might never have sent that. And then maybe a month later, you're on Canada AM. Looking for me. And I'm like, well, I guess it's okay.
I guess it's time to send him the letter that I've already written. Yeah, wow, that's wild. It almost happened once, I remember. Long before the TED Talk, I was doing a talk in Moncton, New Brunswick, and I was sharing the story because I'd shared the story about you for more than a decade. And this guy stands up and he said, I'm an RCMP officer. I was stationed in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia at that time. And I had a light brown jacket and my heart stops and I'm sweating. I'm like, oh my God, is this the moment? This is like pre-contemplative, way before I ever thought of it. And then it turns out it wasn't him. So I think if I think back, that might have been the earliest seed of when I started to get the idea to look for you. Because it was just it had been bubbling inside me for so long. And then for whatever reason, I don't know if I believe in fate or something, but I don't know. I've just got an awful lot of evidence to support it.
There's some crazy coincidences, right? In everything, yeah.
Unusual, yep. Yeah. So you write this letter. A month later, I start looking for you publicly. Mm-hmm. Some friends or family members reach out to me and ask me to send if they can send me your letter, if you can send me the letter. And you emailed it to me. I think it was like in the early or middle afternoon or something like that. But I remember seeing it come in and not reading it right away because for whatever reason, I was suddenly terrified because I just started to appreciate, holy crap, what did I just do?
Things happened really fast.
They really did. Like it was incredible. I didn't think I'd ever, first of all, I didn't even know if you were real, if you existed. And if you were, I didn't think I'd ever actually find you. It just all seemed like such a small chance. And then suddenly, a few hours later, here you are, right? So I remember when I did, I opened the email. It was like midnight or something that night. That was, again, completely accidental. It's not like, oh, I'm going to read it at the same time. He saved my life, you know, 12 years earlier. It was just, for whatever reason, I finally willed up the courage and I recorded myself for some reason, because I'm normal when I record myself at super vulnerable times in my life. And I read the letter that you sent to me. And that's when, you know, I mean, the search itself, the Canada AM spot, went viral immediately, pretty much all over the world. Mm-hmm. And then I posted this video, and that too gets picked up everywhere. The New York Daily News and the Independent in the UK and the Toronto Star takes it. Every major news outlet in Canada takes it. Mm-hmm. Suddenly you're a celebrity. Sorry about that too, yeah. By the way. And I've thought about this a lot because you and I have never talked about this. I don't think we have anyway. I kind of really pushed you into the spotlight.
Admittedly, I am a shy person. If I have an option to kind of like bow out of things or go to the back of the room, that's usually where you'll find me.
Right.
And so a lot of this was very overwhelming. Sure. Because they're getting phone calls and emails and just wanting to do interviews and appearances and things like that. So,
what was it like for you when Rosie O'Donnell said your name and complimented your hair?
my barbershop loves that one. So at the time, it was Sailor Bups. So shout out to Sailor Bups. that was pretty funny. That was awesome.
We were contacted by some producers from Ellen.
Ellen was kind of the crazy one because this would have been after we had met. That also kind of got a lot of attention mm-hmm. publicly.
Yeah, this story really had legs. We popped back up together quite a few times.
Yeah, we had both appeared on Canada AM, and then after that aired, I was getting a lot of messages and phone calls and things, just friends and family and just people and strangers just with really nice things to say. And it was really overwhelming in a great way. It was really nice. But my partner Jenna and I were in Toronto at the time for that. And it was a kind of just a long day of media. And then I like talking to a lot of people just a lot of thanks. Mm. And I needed a break. I was just kind of overwhelmed by the end of the day.
Sure.
So I had turned my phone off, and Jenna and I just laid down, put a show on in the hotel room. I just wanted to just have a little break, turn my brain off, and I forget we were watching. But anyway, so we watched the show. It's only about a half an hour, and then I'm like, I'm going to check my phone again. So I turned back on, and I had a missed call, and it was a missed call from Burbank, California. Oh, and Jenna starts... just flies up and she, that's where Ellen is from. Yeah, so I'm like, no. And then I hit my messages, and sure enough, it was a producer from the Ellen show calling, wanting to just touch base with me about things.
Yeah.
And so I called back and got through right away. And they said that they would kind of take the show or take our story into consideration, but it turns out it was never really followed
up. They never followed it. And when I followed up with them, they had said that they had just finished. I don't know if this is a reason or not. They always give you all kinds of nice reasons when they don't follow a story.
Yeah.
But just that the only reason was that it was the end of the season and they had finished recording for the season.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what they said, I think, to me, too. Yeah. Was just we're wrapping things up, but it's kind of like on the back burner. But we'll keep it in consideration for next season, maybe.
Right.
Or so that in itself, just to be contacted by the Ellen show was awesome. It was cool, pretty kind of cool.
Yeah. So now you mentioned coming up to Toronto because I think that's important because there was a bit of a gap of time between when we connected mm-hmm. And when we actually met. I mean, I knew I needed to meet you.
Mm-hmm.
So we brought you up to Toronto and put you up in a beautiful suite at the Shangri-La Hotel.
Far better
Hotel,
than anything
right?
I've ever been in.
And it was funny because, and I tell people this sometimes on in talks that, if you tell people a really great story, they just give you a bunch of free shit. It's great. It's like, awesome. Yeah. No, but we're doing lots of shout outs, but the Shangri-La Hotel in Toronto, one of the nicest hotels in the city, they were just so supportive.
That's awesome.
Of bringing us together.
And I mean, I'm amused by small things that like, had a very modest upbringing. So
yeah, likewise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, the drapes have a remote control. Yeah. But yeah, no, it was a beautiful hotel. And I loved staying there. So yeah, even that, as we were walking in, I'm like, Jenna, I think, is that goldfish in the floor? Like,
yeah, yeah. What an experience. Yeah. Wow. Well, I figured it was the least I could do was get you a free.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed the experience. It was great.
No, but then, so we schedule the meeting, and then Canada AM cameras, of course, come along. Mm-hmm. They had a whole crew with us that time.
Yeah.
There was one with you, one with me, and we met downtown outside of City Hall in Nathan Phillips Square. Mm-hmm. I'm up on the raised terrace thing. I never know what to actually call it. It's like a thing above the canteen mm-hmm. or something. And the camera's with me. And I remember when you came up the stairs, and I didn't see your face the first time when we were together and you were saving my life on the bridge. But when I saw your face that time, it's like I recognized you. It's like I knew who you were. I don't know. Maybe you just have a really recognizable face. But I feel it's more that something inside me recognized something in you. That connection that we forged that night was just that powerful.
It was a really intimate moment, but it was a little odd having cameras around in that moment.
Agreed. For sure. And even then, I mean, I had done a lot up until that point, but not nearly as much as I've done since in terms of media work. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't even super comfortable for me, that piece of it. But I'm glad now, and I was glad then, too. That they were able to be a part of it, to document it.
They were incredibly respectful. Everything was great.
They were wonderful. Yeah, they were a great crew. But also, I think I'm most grateful for how many people this story impacted. Like, still, this is a couple of years later now, and still, I hear from people all the time. When I look at the analytics on my website, there's still searches for Mark Hennick and Mike Ritchie. Like, people are still consuming the story. It's incredible. So, you know, I'm grateful that we were able to show a good news story in this respect, because that doesn't always happen.
Exactly. And that was kind of one of the things that, as I said, I'm very shy. And if given the chance, normally I would, like, decline things.
Well, there was nothing normal about the encounter that Mike and I had on the bridge that night. There was nothing normal about our relationship playing out in the glare of the media as it did more than a dozen years later. And in the end, there was nothing that Mike could really do about it, because I had sought him out in public after he saved me. It had been bubbling inside me for years, a necessary part, I think, of figuring out my own story. What I didn't know was that Mike had not only saved me that night on the bridge, he steeled me for some of my most difficult days that I would ever experience. In our next episode, Mike and I meet for the first time face-to-face in downtown Toronto. We explore that night a little bit more. We explore the media that came up around it and some of the trials that I would face later in life. I'm Mark Hennick. You're listening to So-Called Normal.
You've been listening to a special episode of So-Called Normal with Mark Hennick. If you like what you heard, share the episode with others. You can always follow Mark on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, and Instagram at Mark Hennick. Otherwise, you might want to check out his website, markhennick.com. This special series of So-Called Normal has been produced by Mark Hennick and Eye Contact Productions. I'm Dave Trafford.